So, with everybody, I hope you are able to hear me and see me, and also see that PDF there. If you can't see it, the only way you can tell me that things are not working as good is the chat function. So anything that doesn't appear, you have to start typing in the chat and tell me it's not working. Okay, this is the first lecture in my 2012 course on the Arahant and the Four Truths in Early Buddhist Discourse. What we will be doing is reading through chapter 3 and chapter 4 of the Madhyama Agama, maybe not all of chapter 4, depending on how we proceed. And what we do is we take up anything that comes along our way, but at the same time we have a special focus. And the special focus this year is on the conception of the Arahant and on the four novices or four truths in early Buddhism. A general introduction on the Madhyama Arno collection as such I will not be giving today. I have been given such a general introduction last year. So if you like to have some more background on this collection, it would be good if you could have a look at lecture 1 of last year. This can be accessed on the same webpage where you also registered. All the lectures from the past are there available as audio files. And it is during the first part of the first lecture from last year that I give some more ideas on the Madhyama Agama collection as such. Now we have quite a number of new students in the course, and I just briefly like to explain how the whole thing works. Normally during the first part of the lecture I take up the discussion that the participants have been having on the blog. Last year this has been very lively and very interesting, and for me personally it's the most enjoyable part of the whole thing, to see how the participants question and find answers. So normally during the first part of the lecture I take up the comments that I found particularly meaningful or where I should feel I could add something. And during the second part of the lecture then I present the new material. Now, obviously today there hasn't been any blog discussion in past lectures, so today we will follow a different sequence. We start first with my lectures, and after that we have a guest lecture. And I think I'm not going to tell you who is giving the guest lecture, because you will get so excited that you won't listen to me anymore. So just know there's something better to come. Now you still stay with me for some time. And we're going to look at our first discourse. So we are in the Madhyama Agama, third chapter, first discourse. This is Madhyama Agama 21, which has a parallel among the tools of the Anguttara Nikaya. The main topic that we are dealing with in this discourse is the idea of fetters and the relationship to non-return. Non-return is the third of the four stages of awakening recognized in early Buddhism. And as you will be hearing more, as you will be hearing more on the stages of awakening later on during the guest lecture, for the time being, I'll just stay with the text and don't tell you anymore. So I just start reading. And just a second, I want to check if can you hear me? Can somebody tell me if you're able to hear me? Because I have the impression that the tape is not registering. Can somebody just type in the chat and tell me if you are able to hear me? Ah, oh, good, good. Okay, thank you. Yeah, because somehow the audio, like I have the video recording, I have an audio running, and the audio doesn't seem to be registering anything. No, I can't help it for the time being. Just have to continue. At least you can hear me. That's reassuring. And the sound is not good. Maybe I move the mic a little up. Better like this maybe. Okay, I start reading the discourse to you. This is Bhagavan Sariputta speaking. Whenever friends, there truly are two categories of people to be found in the world. Which two? They are those who are non-returners, who have internal fetters and who will not be reborn into this human realm. And there are those who are not non-returners, who have external fetters and who will be reborn into this human realm. So this is the basic distinction we get. The non-returner who still has internal fetters and the one who is not a non-returner and who has external fetters. Now we'll get a more detailed explanation of the first one. Suppose someone observes the training in the precepts without transgression or compromise, without blemish or defect. He practices in this way abundantly, overcomes impediments, and is praised by the worthy ones for being well cultivated and well endowed in the training. He further trains in disenchantment regarding sensual desires, in dispassion, and in abandoning sensual desires. Hence he attains a peaceful liberation of the mind. So we get three basic levels described here. The first is simple maintaining of moral conduct. Then the practitioner goes beyond sensuality. And then he is able, or she is able, to develop concentration, peaceful liberation of the mind and absorption. So such a practitioner, and I continue with the discourse, with the breaking up of the body at death, he passes beyond the gods that feed and dress food and is born among the mind-made gods. Such a person, then, with friends, is called a non-returner, who has internal fetters and who will not be reborn into this human realm. So the idea of gods that feed on gross food is simply meant to tell us that this practitioner is born in a very high celestial realm where the gods are made of mind-made. Now we get the second place. And as I'm moving up and down the PDF, in case you are not able to see this move up and down, then again you have to tell me through the chat function. I continue reading from the discourse. Suppose someone observes the training in the precepts, guards against breaking the code of rules, and skillfully controls his comportment in accordance with proper conduct. He trains in the precepts in his way, seeing great danger in even the slightest transgression, and being apprehensive of it. Such a person, when with friends, is called one who is not a non-returner, who has external fetters, and who will still be reborn into this human realm. So the basic distinction that the Madhyama Agama discourse is presenting to us here is between morality as such, maintaining the precepts as such, which is the second place, and using this as a basis to develop dispassion, and then to develop concentration in order to reach non-return. Now, if we look at the Anguttara Nikaya parallel, we find that here we have quite a different presentation. We have three different cases. One is internally fettered, and that is somebody observes moral conduct, is reborn in heaven, and then returns to this world. Then somebody is externally fettered, again moral conduct, he or she reaches a liberation of the mind, is reborn in heaven, and does not return to this world. And then, in the third case, also somebody who is externally fettered, again the development of morality, the development of dispassion, the person is reborn in heaven and does not return to this world. Yeah, if we compare these two versions, at least I'm in a difficulty because I don't really know what to make out of this. The difference is quite pronounced. You see, we have two cases in the Madhyama Agama, and they seem to be quite simple. And we have these three cases in the Pali version. And when we just read the discourse, we don't really, it's not immediately evident what this being internally fettered or externally fettered means. When the commentary explains, internally fettered refers to somebody who has fetters to the sensual realm, that is the human realm and the lower heavenly spheres. And somebody who is externally fettered is fettered to the material and the immaterial realms. These are the celestial realms that correspond to the attainment of absorption and the immaterial attainment. On that commentary explanation, we are certainly able to make some sense out of the presentation in the Pali version. How this relates to the Madhyama Agama, which of the two is the more original, convincing? I simply don't know. This is one of those cases where we study the two versions and we just have to kind of let them stand side by side and leave it at that, I think. Yeah, then in both versions, however, we have a similar progression of ideas where there is then some gods and they come and they tell the Buddha about the teaching that Venerable Sariputta has just given. And on being told about this teaching, and the Buddha then visits Sariputta and approves of the exposition that Venerable Sariputta has given. And then he makes this statement. I read it out from the Chinese. Sariputta, those gods of evil mind are able to stand together on the tip of an arm. 20, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, or 60 of them, without obstructing one another. Sariputta, it was not after being born into the heavenly realm. It was while still in the human realm, that is, in a former life, that those gods of even mind cultivated a good mind, extensively and greatly, and thereby acquired the ability to stand together on the tip of an oar. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, or 60 of them, without obstructing one another. Therefore, Sariputta, one should cultivate tranquility, tranquility of the sense faculties, tranquility of the mind, and tranquility in one's physical, verbal, and mental actions. We have a question about how many angels are able to stand on the tip of them. All is something that apparently was not only of interest to medieval Christians, but also to Buddhists. I am not entirely sure what we should make out of this. My personal take would be to take it as a reference to a belief existing already in ancient India on certain gods and their abilities. And that the real point is not paragraph 1 and 2 that you see now on the screen, but paragraph 3. How these gods were able to get to these abilities. Already in paragraph 2, we are told it was not that they did that in some way when they were already in heaven, but that their abilities, whatever we think of them, were acquired in a former life in the human realm. And these devas are called even minded, that is, Pali would be Samadeva. And that is actually, I think, the real topic for us. These devas were able to reach these abilities because they had practiced an even mind. They had developed tranquility, they had developed concentration. And the last paragraph tells us how. It tells us they cultivated tranquility of the sense faculties, of the mind, and in their actions. So I think the real point is to show us that the development of concentration and tranquility is not something that just comes about like this, you sit on the cushion and then it happens, but rather tranquility is something that in order to express itself in the actual meditation sitting has to be a flavor that pervades the whole life. If there is tranquility in one's physical, verbal, and mental actions, or let us just start with the physical actions. If there is tranquility in the physical actions, I'm not sure this has an effect on the mind. If there is no overt tranquility on the verbal actions, even more so this has an effect on the mind. And then tranquility of the sense faculties. Not being distracted between here and there, up and down, but being centered. All of these stipulate those basic requirements of training that enable us then, when we sit on the meditation cushion, to experience tranquility. So the main points that I think we can gather from this discourse, I suggest then you are certainly free to add or correct me. First of all, morality, keeping the precepts, ethical behavior, this is the very foundation of the practice, and it should certainly never be underestimated. But, or nevertheless, only morality is not enough. It should lead on to discretion. And discretion is then what leads to mental tranquility and concentration. And such tranquility is something that can be developed, or should be developed, I should say, at all levels. From everyday bodily and verbal activities, all the way up to the famous peaceful liberations of the mind, where the mind is quite literally liberated, temporarily, because of the attainment of concentration, of the inner peace of the quiet mind. Yeah, at this point I will stop briefly to allow for any question or comment you might be having. I should add that the Madhyama Agama and the Anguttara Nikaya discourse both have similar conclusions. They say that non-Buddhist practitioners are at a loss because they don't get to hear such teachings. So we are lucky to be able to get such teachings. At least in that aspect, the two versions agree. So, Rashmi, are you saying that venerable, what is the meaning of dispassion, please? Oh, that is such a beautiful word in Pali. Wonderful question. Viraga. Dispassion basically is this idea of not being running after sensual pleasures, of becoming increasingly independent within, of the need of input through the senses that is pleasurable. So dispassion actually is based on the realization that true happiness can only be found in the mind itself. So instead of trying to find it outside through the senses, seeing a beautiful object, tasting a pleasant taste or whatever it is, we realize that that which gives us happiness is anyway the mind, and the evaluation of outer objects as pleasurable leads us to be dependent on them. But real happiness can be found in the mind itself during concentration. And so the attractions of the outer world lose their attraction. They fade away. And this is actually the second meaning of the term dispassion, viraga. Viraga has these two nuances of meaning. One is the dispassion, not having passion, raga, no raga. And the other one is ranjati, color, the discoloring, the fading away. The so-called beauties of the outer world lose their colorful attraction because the mind has found a point of reference within that no longer needs that external input. There is a question by Tai Tai Yong Hu. My internet connection is very poor. How can this video be downloaded? Yeah, you can't download the video, but you can try to listen to it again on the OLAT. I can't help much with that, I'm sorry. What is Dija, Bhante, when the script talks of gods? How would you define them? Ah, that's a good question, yeah. I think if we want to take the early Buddhist scriptures seriously for the way they represent early Buddhism, We have to accept that God, the existence of supernatural beings, was an integral part of the early Buddhist teachings. It is not necessary for anyone in the modern world who wishes to follow the Buddhist form of practice to accept or believe in God. This is certainly not the case. And it is perfectly fine for anybody who says, look, I haven't seen any of these gods, and you tell me what you like about these gods, but until they come here and say hello, I'm not going to believe it. And that is perfectly fine. Gods are not part of a belief system that Buddhism says you have to believe this and otherwise you can't practice. But if we want to fully understand and appreciate the teachings of early Buddhism within the historical context, then I think we have to accept the fact that as far as the scripture allows us to judge, gods were an integral part of the world or view of the world in which the Buddha and his disciples lived. We get numerous discourses for Buddha traveling to heaven to visit this or that god, and God's coming down to earth to give him the latest news, and they have the discussions. So these are, as far as we're able to tell, meant to be really existing supernatural beings. This is the way the text presents them to us. Good question. So there's the next question. Adam Clark. So the question might arise across the canon as to whether internally fated or externally fated is a better phrase for anagamis or sakatagamis. Yeah, the teaching in the Anguttara Nikaya discourse on internally fated and externally fated is one that I am not fully clear on. The idea of distinguishing that between sensual realm and material immaterial realm makes some sense. Without wanting to say that the Madhyama Agama must be the correct one, I find the very simple teaching in the Madhyama Agama speaks much more to me. This very simple, and I briefly go back to the point here again that we had. You see, there's one, and he practices morality and disenchantment or dispassion, and he attains concentration, and so he is able to become a non-returner. And there's another one who just practices the precepts, which is very good, but he will definitely be reborn in this human realm. That to me is a very simple teaching, and it relates very much to the point that you make, because the one who has not developed the concentration could, we suppose, at most be a once returner, one who does return to this world. Well, I do not want to go into the question of whether we need absorption or not for stream entry or once return. We discussed that in quite detail during the last lecture. But it's a good question, Adam. And, yeah, thank you for asking that question. Anyway, it seems like my connection isn't very good either. Can be Rama also mean impermanence? Yeah. That is, in fact, the second sense of fading away. Something that fades away is the second. Impermanence means it comes and goes, and fading away is just going away. It's disappearing. It is fading away. And the two are interconnected. Because precisely because things are impermanent, precisely because they are fading away, we lose our passion for them. We become dispassionate. Rosa Graham, are there any contradictions between the Madhyama Agama and the Anguttara Nikaya? Good question. Let me put it like this. There are no contradictions that I can solve. Sometimes we have the case that one version says something that simply makes less sense than the other. This is one of the rare cases, and I would have loved not to have this as the first one to confront you with, but I can't change the order of the discourses. This is one of those where we just stand there and see the one and see the other, and by the present moment, I simply don't know. maybe on the blog somebody more intelligent than me will solve the whole thing and give us an explanation. I say, ah, sure, I know it all the way, it must be like this, but at this I have to commit ignorance. And I can only say there's two different presentations here. This can easily happen during oral transmission. And both of them make some sense. Martin Gallagher is unable to hear anything. Yeah, as the others are able to hear, I'm not quite sure what I could do to solve that. Rosa Brown, do you think gods belong to culture rather than to Dharma? Are they metaphoric perhaps? Yeah, they are definitely part of the ancient Indian culture, you are right. And as I try to say also, they are not an essential integral aspect of the Dharma. And they are sometimes also metaphoric, you're right, because we know there is another god called Mara, kind of the Buddhist devil, but he's a very sweet devil, not territorial somebody who is very frightening. He's more like a fool, kind of making stupid things and then making a fool of himself. And the same word Mara is sometimes also used metaphorically, very clearly. So there's a double way. Sometimes this Mara is an actual god who walks in and flies in, whatever, and hello, and meets the Buddha and talks with the Buddha and says this and that. And other times it's just used metaphorically. So we have both sides side by side. It's good that you mentioned that, and I was able to complement a little bit what I said about that. They can sometimes be metaphorical in some, but we should not think that all gods are merely a metaphor in the sutras. Marius Kropotsky, where could I find the full text of Madhyama Agama? Yeah, the Madhyama Agama is at present being translated by myself and a team of translators. And the text that we are working with now is so far unpublished. It is probable that the first volume of this translation will be coming out next year, and then you could buy it from Numata. But at present, the text is not available, and I can also not give you the text because it's copyright. Still, he's asking whether the audio will be available for download this year. The audio will be available in a few hours on the OLED page if it works. The thing is, I have the impression it's not working. You see, you have this monkey who is not very good with technical issues. So at least the video seems to be working, so the video will definitely be there, and maybe from the video I can make a copy of the audio. Yeah. Oh, wonderful, so many questions. Thank you very much. I think at this point, we are slowly coming to a conclusion of our discussion. The audio quality is not that Lisa Frankfurt says. Good. At least somebody can hear me. And we leave the next discourse for the next session, because there's almost an hour with the guest lecture. And now I think I have to tell you who's going to give the guest lecture. It's Peter Bodhi. Yeah. I'm so happy about this. He kindly agreed to give us an introductory lecture on the Arahant. Yeah, I think Bhikkhu Bodhi doesn't need much introduction, but I mean, most of you will have come across him because of his wonderful translations, Majjhima Nikaya, Samyutta Nikaya, and the Anguttara Nikaya is finished, I heard, soon coming out, and also his study of the commentaries in several publications. And Bhikkhu Bodhi has PhD in philosophy in 1972 from Claremont Graduate School, and the same year he went forth as a monk. There'll be more information on him on the On the blog, I'll be creating two blogs this time. One, a short blog for whatever further discussion on the one discourse that I presented we may be having, and one blog for discussion what Bhikkhu Bodhi presents us. I'm not sure if he has the time, but it is possible at least that he will visit the blog and answer himself. So, yeah. Yeah, so this is what I have. Now, there's one more question by Marius Kropovsky. Bantu do you by God mean Devas? Yes, definitely. God is the English term, Devas is the Pali term. So at this point, I think I'll switch over to Bhikkhu Bodhi, and yeah, thank you for your attention, for the nice questions, and yeah, enjoy Bhikkhu Bodhi's talk on the Arahants.